welcome to episode 4 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system in every way that needs reform, which unfortunately is wider than normally you would hope for. My name is Josh Ho. I'm a former debate coach, master's in international relations. I also spent 3 years in prison, and I'm currently a freelance writer, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope, available on Amazon. Joel.
Hi there. My name is Joel Barson, and I'm Josh's acolyte.
I don't know if that's... you also work in supportive housing, right?
Yeah, there's that too.
Okay. Yeah. So today we're going to be talking about bail.
Yeah. When we were preparing for this podcast, Josh, in addition to the reading that you gave me, my homework in preparation, I couldn't help but think of the 1988 movie Midnight Run with Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro, which is my, I feel like that was my education on the bail system. That was a good movie, too.
It was a good movie. It's probably, as I said a second ago, the best Charles Grodin movie, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know how true to life it was. I know you have a deeper understanding of these things than me. Do you remember enough about the movie to...
Well, I mean, I don't think most people's experience with bail has a lot to do with bounty hunting or with fleeing. You know, most of what we're going to talk about is the actual need for bail itself in its current format and if it's a good system. Obviously, one of the risks with bail is, or any system, is that someone who's been accused of a crime takes off, you know, flees. And that's what Charles Grodin's character did in that movie.
And presumably, on its surface, this is the scenario that the system is obsessed with, right? When we talk about mass incarceration, so much of that problem is a result of an enormous amount of people being in jail while they are still innocent.
Yeah, the vast majority of people who go to jail are people who have yet to have been convicted of a crime, and the
innocent from a legal standpoint,
right? And the two concerns are that they are actually guilty and dangerous, and that they'll, if they're allowed to leave before their trial, that they'll be able to commit more crimes in the community, or that they'll take off and not appear for their hearings and their trial.
So maybe we should back up just a minute, and perhaps you can take us through Bail 101.
Bail 101. Okay, well, like I said, bail was originally created to ensure that less people... It was actually a noble idea to try to allow more people to get out and deprive the least liberty possible. There's some weirdness about it, though, in that part of what creates bail is the notion that you can attach a cash value to the amount of risk a detainee poses to the community or a risk that they might flee. These are obviously kind of strange things to kind of think about because, you know, even in an actuarial sense, it's hard to imagine that there's a magical dollar amount that determines if someone is or is not a risk or would or would not be a risk or would or would not flee.
Does this lead us to the distinction between secured bail and unsecured bail?
Sure. When you first go to jail, within a day or two, you're taken in front of a judge for a bail hearing. That judge makes a number of possible decisions, one of which is should you be released on your own recognizance. That almost never happens. The second is, are you a person who qualifies for bail at all? In other words, is your level of dangerousness too high to allow bail? So if you are bailable, if the judge just decides that you're bailable, then the judge has to decide what amount bail should be set at. And also if that bail, whatever the bail is, should it be secured or unsecured? Secured bail is when the amount has to be paid before you're released from custody. Unsecured bail is when you have to pay the amount only if you don't appear for court.
So on its face, this seems like it's a logical system. And yet,
except for the whole cash determines
right.
So
it goes wrong, though. I mean, this is a system that like so much of the criminal justice system, unfairly targets and impacts the poor.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, on its face, the idea is that there's an amount that's a general amount could be applied to anyone who is arrested, and that amount will determine if they'll flee or if they'll commit more crimes. And so regardless of your situation or your station, this amount actuarially, like an insurance or whatever, is applied, and then it determines how, you know, theoretically, there isn't actually a, in some cases there's a table, it's called a bail schedule, but, you know, for the most part, the idea is just that in every situation, you'll be able to apply an amount, and that amount will determine, you know, that amount will be appropriate to determine the right outcome. The problem is not everybody has the same ability to pay, and so bail becomes prohibitive for anyone who has, you know, who's in poverty at a pretty significant, a pretty substantial rate. And since most bail is secured bail, like judges generally decide that secured bail is the way to go in most instances, you have to either pay the entire amount yourself or acquire the services of a bail bondsman, which then means you have to probably pay 10% to 13% of the total amount of the bail the judge sets just in order for the bail bondsman to provide surety, in other words, to insure the total amount with the court.
So a few moments ago, I said that this issue was a critical and maybe not to most people obvious part of the mass incarceration problem. How big a problem is this in terms of scale numbers?
Well, I want to kind of point to two pieces of information. One is from this really recent, like within the last week, report that was put out by the Criminal Justice Policy Program at Harvard Law School. The report's called Moving Beyond Money, and it's a kind of a review of everything that has been done about research-wise about bail. This is what they said. A 2013 review of New York City's jail system showed that more than 50% of jail inmates held until case disposition remained in jail because they couldn't afford bail of $2,500 or less. Most of these people were charged with misdemeanors. Of these non-felony defendants, 31% remained incarcerated on monetary bail amounts of $500 or less. Nationwide, 34% of defendants are kept in jail pre-trial solely because they are unable to pay a cash bond. And most of these people are among the poorest third of Americans. National data from local jails in 2011 showed that 60% of jail inmates were pre-trial detainees, and that 75% of those detainees were charged with property, drug, or other nonviolent offenses. In fiscal year 2014 alone, local jails admitted 11.4 million people, and the nationwide average daily population included 467,500 pretrial defendants.
I'm pretty sure in my notes here, yeah, here it is, that, I mean, those are staggering numbers. And just looking at New York, 7,000 people, 7,000 are detained pretrial at Rikers Island every single day, every single day.
Yes, and, you know, obviously there's a ton of documentaries and other information about Rikers, which has kind of become a national symbol for the problems with jails. If you've heard of Just Leadership USA, one of their biggest campaigns is the Close Rikers campaign. And probably one of the most famous instances of abuses in jail is the Kalief Browder story, which I think was made into a movie and has also had several documentaries made about it.
Just maybe just another note about that, the scale of this issue. I have in our notes that the number of Americans sitting in jail without a conviction, is larger than most other countries' entire incarcerated population.
Yeah, and you know, when you think of, I mean, we have different elements of the mass incarceration problem. One of the things we talked about last week is as the prison population has gone down, the jail population has gone up. And so, yeah, you know, we may be solving parts of the problem, but...
And this does sort of harken back to episode one, where we talked about the difference between jail and prison, but... For our discussion today, almost all the people whom we're discussing are in jail, and maybe it's a good time for you to explain again what the special and unique risks and dangers and symptoms and consequences of JLR.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we're both pretty familiar, and I think everybody hopefully listening is familiar at least at some level with the stories of Kalief Browder and Sandra Bland, who both unfortunately died in jail before they could get release. Closer to home for us in Michigan, since 2012, at least 18 inmates have died at the Macomb County Jail. This is particularly important to me because that's where I was housed for 3 months. And that's, I don't know if y'all remember the story from an earlier, I think episode one, where I talked about the mental health facility that was talking about Macomb County. And I don't think Macomb is exceptional. I just think in every state, there's a couple of Rikers, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are places where a lot of terrible things happen. We face, you know, most jails face incredible overcrowding problems because you're taking everyone who's been charged of a crime in any particular county on any particular day and shoving them all in one facility, and the wheels of justice turn pretty slowly. So instead of having a quick churn, for the most part, it's a lot of very slow burn, and you've got a really crowded, overcrowded situation. There's a lot of violence in jail. I talked about how while prison is incredibly violent, it's kind of nothing compared to jail, because I think part of it's because so many people are crammed together, and also because there's so many, you know, street issues that are, you know, a lot of people know each other. There's a lot of issues between different, you know, gangs and crews. There's also just a lot of, you know, it's a very weird mix of people, because you've got a lot of people who have never been arrested before and have no idea what you're doing, and you got a lot of people who've been there a lot of times and know how to take advantage of people who have just come in for the first time.
So there are all these risks, and it's shocking to me.
Let me say one more risk. We're in the middle of this opioid crisis. One of the really unhealthy risks, it's a really bad way to get someone off of, or to recover from, or to get clean from drugs, to force them to totally withdraw on their own without any medical intervention. And that obviously is a big problem in jails. I just want to mention that. So
it sounds cruel and inhuman, basically. But the number one cause of death is
suicide. Yeah, suicide is a huge, I mean, it's pretty depressing. I mean, like I said, the very first question they ask you is, do you feel depressed? The reason they ask you that question isn't because they're concerned about you. It's because the number one reason people die in jails is because they commit suicide.
So there are mechanisms in place in which they're theoretically trying to account for that, but they're not very good at it, obviously.
Well, they're not very good at accounting for it, and their answer to it is, like I said in the first episode, is to slap you in a, you know, 24-hour surveillance room where you're probably more isolated, afraid, scared, unsure of what's going on, and depressed than you were before you went in. It's not really a situation where you're getting good mental health care or having your depression dealt with in any real way. It's really just observation, and observation in such a strange and disconnected way that it can't really in any way, shape, or form help people with their mental health at the moment or long term.
And all of these awful trappings that we've just gone through all are sort of wrapped up in the criminal justice system sphere that a person who's in the situation is going to be connected to. But there are other implications for any ordinary person in their own life for being locked up when they have not yet been convicted of a crime.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty hard to go to work when you're in jail.
Right.
And if your job is the kind of job that isn't going to let you miss a bunch of days, when you come back, you're probably not going to have a job. If you have kids, you're going to have a hard time taking care of your kids. Say you have some healthcare needs that need to be taken care of. It's going to be a while before the jail catches up to those needs, if they do at all. So you got a lot of, and I think, one of the things we really should talk about, because we've talked about it, it's really omnipresent in my mind in all of these discussions, is the racism that comes into play.
There was a study at Princeton just last year.
Yes. So here's what they concluded. We find evidence of significant racial bias in our data, ruling out statistical discrimination as the sole explanation for the racial disparities in bail. Marginally released white defendants are 19.8 percentage points more likely to be rearrested prior to disposition than marginally released black defendants with significantly more racial bias among observably high-risk defendants. Our estimates of racial bias are nearly identical if we account for other observable crime and defendant differences by race, suggesting that our results cannot be explained in black-white differences in certain types of crimes.
So this is really a thread that has run through every episode of our podcast, is that the entire system, rife as it is with flaws and with inhuman elements, is all, in addition to that, structurally biased against African Americans
and also Hispanics. The Harvard thing that we talked about before talks about the Hispanic disparity too, in both getting bail and, you know, the reason why that study we were talking, the Princeton study we were just talking about, is important is because, you know, that means that there's a lot more white people being released early than black people being released. And the same is true for Hispanics, which means that they're not given a chance at bail either for structural reasons or for reasons of the way they're disposed, which is what that Princeton study is talking about. The judges tend to give African-American people who are up for bail more less chance of bail than they would for similarly situated white.
And I can't help but think that there are other biases as well, such as financial ones. One of the pieces of reading that you gave to me was an October 19th article from The Nation. And in it, it mentions how in New Orleans, the judge, the parish where the criminal district court is located, gets kickbacks, legal kickbacks, based on bail that's collected.
Yeah, so basically the state, Louisiana, passed laws that made it so that bail bonds people have to give a percentage of the amount that they collect back to the courts. And so you have a situation where if judges charge more for bail, the state gets more money, which goes into the courts. So it seems like a pretty clear conflict of interest.
And in that same article, it quotes this judge, Judge Cantrell, who says that he refuses to set bail lower than $2,500, quote, no matter the facts of the case. He says, we don't go any lower than $2,500 in this court.
Yeah, and, you know, there's obviously not a lot of reason for that, or reasoning for that, that makes a lot of sense. I frankly am baffled by the stories in that article about that particular judge.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as someone who works with folks who are often indigent, $2,500 can be a monumental amount of money.
Yeah, I won't lie to you. If someone said that I had to give them $2,500 right now, I'm not really sure that I could do that, or even close, really, to be honest with you.
Yeah, so this is just another broken and unfair part of an unfair system.
Yeah, and in fairness, if you got a $2,500 decision from a judge in terms of bail, if it's a surety bond, if it was you know, a secured bail, then you would have to pay 10% of that. But that 10% you would never get back. And so, let's say you were innocent, and your bail was $10,000. You know, now you're starting to you've basically donated $1,000 to a bail bondsman for nothing. You didn't do anything. You know, I mean, it's a tough. You know, that's a tough system. When you're a poor person to start with, and you're a lot of times having to mortgage your property or your house, you know, to get it out, and then you're not going to get some of that money back when you didn't do anything, that's pretty tough.
Yeah, no doubt. And then behind all of this, another theme that keeps coming up is, well, all of this is sort of based on the pretense that it's making us safer. There's research that suggests that may not be correct, right?
Right. There's a substantial amount of research that shows that pretrial detention decreases societal safety and makes people more likely to commit new crimes, which might seem counterintuitive. But the reason they suspect this is true is because the destabilizing effect of even a short time in jail can really cause some serious problems. You know, it disrupting your life in such significant ways that you're more likely to be unstable.
And there are plea bargain implications also.
Yeah, I mean, Khalif Browder is another example of this. You know, essentially, if your situation in jail is dangerous enough or violent enough, you know, like say that you're just someone who's getting picked on in jail, you know, or you're being extorted, or you're being physically beaten, or even sexually abused on a regular basis, you're going to have a lot more of an incentive to participate in a plea bargain process. And they're going to come at you with a lot of, you know, like, agree to this and we'll let you out. And, you know, if your life's at risk when you're in jail, you know, you're much more likely to admit to something that you didn't do.
And this may not be constitutional.
Right. And, you know, it's weird, you know, the Harvard research we were talking about above, or the Harvard report that we were talking about above, kind of talks about how the Supreme Court has held that a person may not be jailed based on their inability to make a monetary payment unless the court has made an inquiry into the person's ability to pay and determined that non-payment was willful or that no other alternative measure will serve the government's legitimate interest. Though elemental, this principle is violated routinely in jurisdictions all over the country. And the chain of court decisions I looked up that kind of established this are Bearden versus Georgia, Williams versus Illinois, and Tate versus Short. And so there's at least a principle that's been elucidated by the Supreme Court that this shouldn't happen. This kind of so, like I said before, and we'll talk about this in just a second when we get to alternatives. A lot of times the courts use non-individualized methods of determining bail that have nothing to do either with your ability to pay or with your likelihood of reoffense, aside from some kind of bail schedule. And it seems like no matter what else you think about the constitutionality of cash bail, that it should probably be individualized.
So this is a system that is clearly entrenched throughout our criminal justice process, throughout the country. What alternatives could there possibly be to this tried and well-ensconced method?
Well, I think there's two kind of main categories of solutions. The first ones are solutions that maintain bail, and the second one are solutions that get rid of bail as we currently know it. So some solutions that maintain bail that seem to be sensible to me, you know, one is to eliminate cash bail for misdemeanors entirely. It seems strange that a bunch of people would be left in a place where they could be killed for a misdemeanor. Yeah. And not released on their own recognizance. It seems like, you know, unless there's a really good reason, the whole difference between a misdemeanor and a felony is that a felony is something that, you know, there's, you know, a real risk to society, theoretically. You know, maybe we should not have bail for misdemeanors. I think that another pretty good alternative, I think, is to do individualized assessments of a people's ability to pay. I think that would be a pretty good way to determine things a little bit differently. I think, you know, one thing that should happen as a part of that is to eliminate bail schedules. I think that would be a good idea, probably, at least in that way. You're making sure that in each instance that you take a look at the actual context. It's kind of like mandatory minimums in a way when you have a bail schedule. You know, even though you haven't been convicted of a crime, and so you're not being sentenced, in a sense you're being sentenced to bail. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to spend time incarcerated as a result of your inability to pay when it's not individualized. And the risk assessments that are done should probably take into account the context of what's being done, just like we would in the case of trying to get rid of mandatory minimum sentences or something like that.
There's also the possibility of pretrial service agencies, right? And in our reading, there was the article from the Associated Press.
Hold on for that one for just a second, because That's kind of more about changing the entire bail system. Okay. Let me do one more about the one that's just kind of bail as it is, you know, just kind of reforming the bail. Mm-hmm. And I think there are several jurisdictions. I think Massachusetts is kind of the leader in this, is to end surety bail by allowing direct 10% payments to the courts as opposed to, you know, And then the money gets returned at the end of the trial as opposed to doing it through a bail bondsman. And don't get me wrong, I totally understand that there's an entire industry that's been built around bail and that there's a lot of bail bonds people that feel like and probably do a lot of good work. And the point isn't that they're bad people or that they're, you know, that they aren't trying to do good things or whatever. The problems that are being created in a lot of ways are being created above their, you know, their situation. Right. And the way that the laws got written and the reason why it incentivizes them to be part of the system, if that's not legitimate, you know, yes, I understand that you know, people earn their money that way, but maybe, you know, there's other ways that, you know, maybe that's not a good thing.
Right.
You know, it could be, it could not be. That's, you know, that's why there's a wide range of possible solutions, I think.
So about solutions that involve a wholesale reconsideration of that system?
Yep. Sorry about the...
Not at all. Yeah, no, that was good.
So what you were going to talk about?
Well, I'm thinking of this article called Locked Up is Cash Bail on the Way Out. It was from March 1st, 2017. And it talks about some of the alternatives. And one that jumped out at me was, or a couple, were supervised release and drug treatment monitoring and possibly drug treatment support.
Well, obviously, I think close to both of our hearts are kind of the idea of harm reduction in terms of, especially in the cases, you know, in drug cases.
Absolutely.
And so one, you know, thought of that is that instead of putting, you know, that there should be diversion and that the first thing that happens when someone comes to jail is that they should be assessed by a social worker or a mental health professional or an addiction professional before they get put in the system, and that instead of being put in jail, perhaps a better alternative would be to be put into some kind of treatment.
This is where so-called pretrial service agencies might fit in.
Sure. And so one thing that could, one way that that could work is instead of having to spend a couple of days in jail, or if you do spend a couple of days in jail, but the assessment had been done, you could be released to a system that's designed to deal with people with your kind of crime. For instance, you know, if you're suffering from addiction or whatever. Now, if that, you know, if that's a better system, you know, it's certainly a better system than charging people a bunch of money and trying to get them to dry out by themselves without any medical supervision, in my opinion.
And if these pretrial service agencies were to become part of this whole process, we would need to be concerned about whether they were set up as for-profit agents or nonprofit, right?
Right. You don't want to replace bail with another system that builds debt.
Right.
So the goal shouldn't be to get rid of cash bail to try to save poor people money and then replace it with a system that puts them in lifetime debt. And so an example of that would be if part of the pretrial or the pretrial services or monitoring services involve, say, GPS monitors. When I was released from prison, I was on a GPS monitor and they were charging me, like I said, more than I was paying in rent per month. And so if that's the case, that's not really an improvement over cash bail, in my opinion. It might be better to be out. There's also, I think, the possibility that if they did a system like that, they could start to leverage it so that it allowed, like, here's an example. In California, they let you choose which jail you stay in based on how much you can pay per day. And so they have kind of like a nice jail and a bad jail. Okay, and it seems to me that some of these pretrial systems could be a lot like that, where, well, you can get out of bail if you can afford to get the pretrial, you know, service. And that really doesn't fix the problem. The problem has to be fixed with an acknowledgement that the problem is based around people who don't have money. And so if money is the answer to the way you're going to, charging them money is your answer, it's probably not a very good answer.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, Josh, I never would have guessed that bail, which seems to have been created so less people would be incarcerated waiting for trial, has become this monumental part of the mass incarceration problem that we're facing as a nation. It's huge, and I'm glad to know more about it because it's shocking how many folks who've not been proven guilty are locked up and suffering and whose lives are disrupted for no safety benefit for any of us.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't want to, you know, I mean, the point isn't necessarily that everybody's innocent. That is a point, and I think a valid point. A lot of what I think we're trying to do with this podcast is to deal with the problem of people who are or have some guilt. And so if the difference for between someone like me who had some guilt, you know, I ended up pleading guilty to my crime, and someone who doesn't, you know, who also has guilt but doesn't have the money to get out, is only the amount of money we have, then is that a just system?
It sounds fundamentally unfair and not the way we would want to work as a culture, as a nation, I would think.
You would hope not. You know, we've kind of had a string of events recently that implicate, you know, our willingness to, you know, or the way that we look at the poor as somehow inherently defective. You know, obviously, as a poor, relatively poor person myself, I don't appreciate that characterization. I don't think it's accurate.
Surely not. You know, that sort of value judgment based on someone's resources seems to me to be inherently flawed and morally wrong.
Yeah, I would have to agree with your assessment there.
Yeah. So, any final words, Josh, about bail?
Well, I just think that whatever system that we First of all, I think we have to move to a different system. I mean, literally people who have yet to be adjudicated, and you know, the old saying is I'd rather have 1,000 guilty people go free than have one innocent person in jail. There are people who literally are dying because they're accused of a crime. I mean, that's not right.
No.
Okay, and that certainly shouldn't be determined based on your ability to pay. Okay, at the heart of this whole thing is that, you know, we have to have some kind of reform, because at the heart of this whole thing is this notion that right now the only thing that determines whether you can get out of jail or not get out of jail is the amount of money you have. Okay, that's not right. You shouldn't be able to get out of jail any different than any other American citizen. We have the same, we should have the same right to whatever exists. That's equal protection. You know, that each of us should be able to actualize the exact same rights in the exact same situations. And when money becomes the barrier to getting free, you know, that does some damage to core principles, in my opinion.
I couldn't agree with you more, Josh. And I really appreciate you making this so clear. It is such a fundamental infraction of what we should how we should be treating the vulnerable individuals who are impacted by this system and who may have some culpability, but who clearly do not deserve to be treated differently merely because of their financial resources or their race.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. Do you have any last, that pretty much your last words? Or
that's it, Josh. Yeah, thanks again.
No problem. So tomorrow I'll be recording my first interview with Lauren Brooke Eisen, who wrote the book Inside Private Prisons. I think it's pretty topical, given that there's some pretty recent information that the Trump administration is going to move to liberalize the use of private prisons by the Bureau of Prisons at the federal level. So this should be a pretty good discussion. I'm looking very much forward to it. She's a very, very smart, very cool person.
Can't wait till...
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
A quick correction. I mistakenly said that both Kalief Browder and Sandra Bland committed suicide while in jail. This is obviously incorrect. Sandra Bland committed suicide in jail, but sadly Kalief Browder committed suicide after his release. Rest in peace, Kalief. We all miss you. In addition, I forgot to mention that we should have accountability standards and training for judges so that they are aware of racial disparities in awarding bail and determining bail amounts, especially given the amount of racial disparity that exists in the system. Finally, my interview with Lauren Brooke Eisen was delayed a week. I will be recording it this Thursday. Joel and I will also be recording two more episodes, one on plea bargaining and another on pre-sentencing investigations and public defenders, sometime next week. You can subscribe to the Decarceration Nation podcast on iTunes or wherever podcasts are aggregated. Please check onpiratesatellite.com for show notes and links to research referred to during each episode. Thanks again for listening, and see you soon.